Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we begin the program by talking with you about Darwin Day and evolution. The annual celebration of Charles Darwin's birthday at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I believe, starts on Thursday, kind of runs through Sunday. It's going to highlight the evolutionary significance of strange life forms, including the octopus and enormous flowers, among other things. And happy to have with us by phone Janet Voigt. She is the Associate Curator of Zoology at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. She's a specialist in cephalopod mollusks, especially octopuses, or octopi, I think. In terms of where she works, it's the deep sea. She holds a PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology from the University of Arizona, and she's one of the featured speakers at UW's Darwin Day events this week in Madison, and she joins us by phone from the Field Museum. And let's see if we got her there. Janet, hi, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for inviting me to chat.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it. You know, I saw this, I saw that you were a specialist in cephalopod mollusks, especially octopuses is what it says on your website, and I thought it was octopi.
Well, actually, it's most correct to say octopuses because of the derivation of the root is from either the Greek or the Roman form that takes the es ending to make it plural rather than converting to I. And I never know which language it is. So, you know, I'm just a Midwestern girl. I'm not really, you know, keen on that Latin and Greek stuff.
You know what? I like octopuses better.
I think it's got a certain ring to it.
And, you know, when you say octopuses, you know, most people know immediately what you're talking about, whereas not everybody might if we say octopi. So there you have it.
Yeah, and then you kind of, you know, the thought comes to mind, oh, what kind of fruit do you use in an octopi?
Very good. Well, let's talk a little bit about evolution. Why do living things evolve?
Well, Darwin's big focus was that evolution happens because of natural selection. And basically, by the time he was thinking about such issues, the world had recognized that individuals are different, be they plants or animals or bacteria, I guess, and that typically that variation is heritable, which means that the offspring of a given individual with unique trait will tend to have that trait. And he also was coming of intellectual age, which he did remarkably quickly, when Malthus was writing about population growth and how the potential for a population of, and I'm a zoologist, so I'm always going to say animals. I ask botanists to forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
Animals have this phenomenal potential to reproduce and just swamp the whole land. Think of brown tree snakes on Guam. It's an introduced animal who don't have any natural predators, natural diseases, and on virtually ad-lib food. They're crawling all over everywhere. And that shows that they have this phenomenal reproductive potential. In a normal population, all that huge number of potential offspring can't survive. And there's got to be some traits that make some individuals better at survival than others. And over time, with each generation, there'll be a net change toward more of the individuals in a population having the more beneficial traits.
Yeah.
That's evolution.
Yeah. But do they always evolve in ways that help their odds of survival?
Well, you know, you can say we're having a really mild winter here, and some of the animals who maybe have to burrow down to get through winter, maybe there were some in the population who didn't quite burrow down so far. And sure enough, so far it's been a mild winter, knock wood. They're going to be able to come up in spring, you know, have a little edge on their conspecific animals, and maybe they'll be able to produce one more offspring. And maybe next year we'll have a better, that's a value judgment, but a mild winter. and their offspring will take off. And then sooner or later, we're going to have one of those cataclysmic winters like you know, you and I grew up with.
Yep, and then it's goodbye.
You know, and you can say, well, that evolution that happened over those mild winters really hit that population upside the head when, you know, conditions changed. So populations are always evolving to suit the current, you know, the current conditions. They're not able to have the perfect awareness of what's going to happen in the future. An individual who goes out, you know, breaks away from home, grows up and seeks his fortune, if only he had known to take a left instead of a right, you know, things could have been different. There's an element of chance, I believe, in evolution, but it is the unifying theory on which biological science is founded these days.
Margaret in Cable, Wisconsin, has a comment. I want to bring her in. Hey, Margaret.
Hi, Larry. Hey, great show. And I just have a humorous little side story to tell you. When I was in first grade, my teacher touched on evolution, and I came home, and I didn't fully understand it, and I asked my mom if my dad used to be an ape. He went on and explained it, so I'm good to go, but I have good genetics.
What did your mom say?
She just explained it to me further, and then I understood. But, you know, I had thought, well, did my dad used to be an ape? You know, because you see those pictures and you think, whoa. So that's it.
Margaret, great story. Thank you.
Goodbye.
I appreciate that story.
That was great.
Things don't happen quite that fast.
Yeah. That kind of highlights why evolution is such a lightning rod in terms of scientific theories. If we didn't talk about how humans got here, I don't think, you know, most people would really be that concerned. And because evolution is such a central tenet in biological sciences, and Dobzhansky, you know, the most famous quote that I know of about evolution is that nothing in the biological sciences makes sense except in light of evolution. Having humans brought down to that level, if you will, of being an animal, being derived from the primordial ooze, is just kind of like just a little bit much for people, I think.
Gary and Boscobel, we turn to you next. Let's see. Can I get you on? Hi, Gary.
Thank you, Larry. I have spent about the last 35 years of my life doing trying to conserve and protect endangered species and threatened species just locally in southern Wisconsin. And I'm amazed at the amount of people who have no understanding of the value of other species and even in this day and age believe that we can do without a lot of other species and wipe them aside with the excuse that we need oil or we need other resources. And I've come to believe that and wonder about the fact is, with the loss of other species on the planet, about one every 15 minutes now, is that going to change the process of human evolution, our direction in evolution, simply by the fact that those each species does, I believe, exert some kind of unseen biological pressure or momentum on another species just simply through their presence? And I'm wondering whether eventually if we eradicate enough species that our evolutionary pathway will start to change in a maybe not such a good direction.
It's something we should all be cognizant of. Now, I can't make specific predictions, but the way we see ecosystems are kind of as webs, so that every species plays a role in one way, but also a role in another way. So, for instance, it may be a predator on a grass, and it may also be prey to birds if it's an insect, or it may be a host for a parasite, a primary first stage that then goes on to parasitize something else. And at this stage of understanding nature, we really don't know the many roles that each individual species plays in the world. When you look at the complexities of the tropical rainforest, I read somewhere in South America there was a new species described every 2 weeks for a period of 10 years.
Yeah.
And that's a tropical rainforest. You know, this is
I mean, I work in the deep sea, so I can say this. It's easy to get to. We hear, we see, we breathe the air. How can that all exist without us really knowing it? I mean, I'm worried about the future. I mean, because of the complexities of life on this planet and how long it's taken for the planet and the complexity of life to get what it is, and how much humans have changed the world in the last century, say. It's phenomenal. Think about, you know, a century ago, most of the U.S. population lived on farms. You know, going to the big city meant going to a population maybe of 100,000 people. I mean, Chicago was like, you know, 20 years after the fire, it was still hog butcher to the world. And today, you can see it from space. And a lot of us who live downtown Chicago, and I'm one of them, we don't see nature and we don't understand those complexities. It's a lot different to go out into a prairie or into a natural woodland than it is to walk through Grant Park where the grass is cut and there's periodically signs about, this area has been sprayed for weeds, please don't touch this for 24 hours.
Yeah.
So our lives have changed so much, and our appreciation of nature with it.
Gary, thank you so much. Raymond in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a retired psychology faculty member. I used to teach a comparative psychology course. And one of the things that we noticed in that comparative psychology research is that there are lots and lots of not-so-adaptive behaviors present in most species. And so the notion that maybe natural selection isn't really based on favoring adaptive traits, but more it's based on pulling out those traits that are most counterproductive might be a constructive way of looking at it. So I thought I'd call and see what your guest has to say about that idea.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Brad, do you mean selecting against the traits that are most, well, make the individuals most vulnerable?
Exactly.
Okay. There's variation in populations, and though, I mean, I don't do behavior, so I'm not that familiar with the literature, but maybe in some scenarios those traits actually are offer a potential payoff.
Well, there's no doubt about it. Like the peacock's tail, for example, the payoff is the guy with the biggest tail reproduces most frequently,
right,
if he survives his tail. But no, what I'm saying is that's a dynamic that I think our evolution theories or theorists have not paid much attention to. So instead of thinking about how nature favors traits, nature also disfavors traits. And I think it gives us a more complete picture of the process if we take that into account and
exactly.
Think about it.
I see where you're going. It's like the peacock's tail. It's like it's an onus for the male who has to carry it. It's big. It's heavy. It throws him off balance. It costs him an energy because he has to eat to maintain it, and then it's got to look good. But that key moment is when he's presenting his glorious tail in front of a bunch of females on a lek, comparing himself to all the other males, and the females assess who they're going to accept sperm from based on who's got the finest tail.
Yeah.
That is the whole raison d'etre for the peacock and his tail. And Darwin knew this. Part of Darwin's wonderful body of work was sexual selection. He understood that an individual doesn't evolve. An individual provides his or her genes to the next generation, and the species as a whole evolves. It's really easy to get sloppy and think about individuals under selection and so they evolve, but we got to be careful.
Thank you, Raymond. Appreciate your call. Janet Voigt, our guest today, Associate Curator of Zoology at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, a specialist in cephalopod mollusks, especially octopuses, and she will be one of the featured speakers at UW's Darwin Day events this week in Madison. Larry Mueller here. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking today about Charles Darwin and evolution with Janet Voigt, Associate Curator of Zoology at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. Great to have her along. Thank you so much for listening in. Are you fascinated by evolution? What captures your imagination about it? Or maybe you've studied Darwin a bit or read some of books about him. What about his work interests you? Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. And Janet, by the way, you you study octopuses, and I think that's part of you're going to be featuring octopuses in your talk in Madison.
That's right. I'm going to talk about octopuses of the world, but mostly in the deep sea, and how there got to be two groups who molecular evidence suggests are totally different, and how they can coexist. Because natural selection is basically animals facing limited resources and trying to use them better. Ecological theory tells you, well, you can't have two animal species or groups competing for the same limited resource without one driving the other extinct. It's like you can't have a 7-Eleven across from a white hen pantry because there's too many convenience stores in the same block. Somebody's going to close up shop. So I'm going to talk about some of the observations I got to make from the deep submergence vehicle Alvin, some of the anatomical work I've done, and just some cool pictures of the animals at 2,000 meters depth.
That must have been that must be a lot of fun.
Well, it's kind of scary, you know, diving in the Alvin.
Yeah.
Alvin's a 7-foot, well, it has been. They're now upgrading it. It has been a 7-foot diameter sphere. They're upgrading it to 7.5 feet diameter, which is just going to be like, whew, first class. And you're in there with two other full-grown people. And I happen to be about 6 feet tall and 7 feet in diameter with two other people and a bunch of stuff really gets to be kind of crowded. And then they close the hatch and they bolt it shut. And then they...
And you better not need to go to the bathroom at that point.
Exactly. Then they pick up the sphere with you and two people you hardly know in it, put it off the end of the ship with an A-frame. And Alvin weighs like 35,000 tons. And they turn it loose, and it floats on the surface until there's a radio link to the ship, and they say, okay, it wipes away, and then it starts to sink. It floods the ballast. And as time goes on, your rate of descent just is based on how heavy the sub is once they flood the ballast containers. Can take 20 minutes to half an hour to go to 1,000 meters. And if you work at 2 or 3 you know, 1,000 meters, that can take an hour, hour and a half. And all the time, the weight of the outside water column is pressing on the sphere. And, you know, most recreational divers, most people on scuba, I mean, a deep scuba dive is 120 feet.
Yeah.
I mean, they can maybe go down there for 10 to 15 minutes, and then they have to come up and avoid the bends, and it's an ordeal. With Alvin, it's rated to 4,500 meters. And I once calculated the outside pressure based on the weight of the water column over that.
Yeah.
It was tons per square inch. And then I had a dive coming up, so I forgot.
Uh-huh.
But because the diving ball itself is round,
yeah,
it's structurally a strong shape. Titanium, you know, that's a really hard metal. They,
yeah,
they make golf clubs out of it. It's got to be pretty strong. And there's just a few weak points, which are where the windows are. So it wouldn't be much good to be diving in the Alvin without being able to look outside. Because when you start getting thoughts about, my God, what am I doing here? You look outside and you think, nobody's ever been here before if you're on the bottom.
Yeah.
If you're going down, when you look out, you can almost always see some bioluminescence of animals. The turbulence of the sub as it falls is stimulating to bioluminesce. You see shapes, and I swear there's different colors, but people tell me, no, it's all about the same green. And there are these beautiful things. And if you can convince a pilot,
the engineer who actually operates the sub to flash on the lights, because you'd think, oh, that's got to be so cool. I want to see it in real light. There's nothing out there. In the midwater, in the part of the ocean between the surface and the bottom, there's this cosmos of animals that we don't even know about because we have almost no way of sampling them. When we run a net through that area, they're so delicate, they just kind of wind up smeared on the net.
Mm.
And when we try and sample them with a submersible like Alvin, well, Alvin's built to work on the bottom. It sinks. And we can't really grab them. It's just not built for it. There are some recent remotely operated vehicles which are being built with the capacity to sample by essentially having a chamber where it can wait until the animal drifts in or have the pilot float the vehicle up enough and then just close it. So the animal is never touched by human, well, by robotic hands.
Right.
So that is the real frontier on our planet in terms of biodiversity, what's out there.
Hmm.
And how they live, because in that area of the ocean, the food, of course, is coming from the surface. Because the sun is making most all of the energy in the ocean by providing energy to the phytoplankton, the tiny microscopic plants that live in the sunlit zones. Over time, things eat them, they poop, the feces fall in the water column, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It takes them maybe 10 hours to fall 1,000 meters. As it falls deeper, other animals come in and use whatever energy is available, whether it be feces or tiny bits of animals who died and fell to the bottom. And food gets harder and harder to find with each depth. And you have a realm where it's totally dark. The food is coming down from above unpredictably, and everybody around you is a predator. And that's where you get the wonderful things like hatchet fish, who have a little lure on their face that glows.
Yeah.
Have copepods, who give out signals of light, and whether or not that's to lure in smaller things that they can eat or to attract mates, is to be determined. And it's just that excitement of discovery and, wow, look at that, that makes me happy. I'm a scientist.
It's that was a wonderful description. Thank you so much for that. Mike in Coon Valley has a comment or a question for you, Janet. Let's go there. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
You're a bet. I do believe in some aspects of evolution and, you know, how species adapt to environmental changes, but I have a hard time believing that we actually evolved from apes. But if we did, how do you explain that there are still apes and that they all didn't become humans?
Well, we didn't specifically evolve from apes, but rather we and chimpanzees and gorillas and orangutans, the great apes, had a common ancestor maybe 10 million years ago, which is a time that boggles my mind. I can't cope with it. And that common ancestor gave rise to different populations, and each of those populations went on its own way. Over time, different features were selected in the different populations, and they evolved into different species. And over the eons, they each became radically different morphologically. I mean, gorillas, I mean, they're huge, they're muscular, they're massive. Chimpanzees, too, they're really big, they're strong. I mean, you remember that chimp attack on a woman some years back. And then our ancestors, we're not that big. I mean, even the biggest Neanderthals is not huge compared to a silverback gorilla. We were somehow had the innovation, the novelty, to use our brains a little bit more, to become a little more upright, evolve a social system, which I agree, the gorillas and the chimpanzees and I'm afraid I don't know much about orangutans, also have. It's not that the gorillas could be us. Gorillas are doing just fine being gorillas. Their ancestors found a niche that let them exploit the jungles and treetops and thrive in that niche. Chimpanzees, they don't want to be like us. They want to be chimpanzees. Their ancestors had the adaptation to make them successful in that chimp niche. And ours are special in a different way. And each of those four groups are now modern successful species that share a common ancestor.
Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate it, Mike. I want to give Diane in Milwaukee a chance as well. Diane, hello to you.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm confused about how Australia has such unusual animals, like with pouches and jumping around. You don't see the same evolutionary pouches in Europe, China,
right.
North and South America, Africa. What accounts for that?
Well, if you think about the history of the Earth, just like there's a theory of evolution that explains all the modern diversity that maybe you can't say, you're talking about 10 million years ago, you can't prove that. Just like that, in geology, there's a theory of plate tectonics, which says, well, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago, because geology is a lot longer science than biology is, the continents moved around over tens of millions of years. The Americas, North and South, and Asia and Europe and Africa were all part of one landmass at one point. Australia, however, was all by itself. It never really hooked up with the rest of the continents after that first primitive mammal group evolved. They were on Australia when it got separated and turned into an island. In the greater landmass, I think it's called Gondwana, it could be Laurasia, the ancestor to mammals was in that marsupial phase, but evolved a new innovation allowing the placenta to form so that all the mammals that are alive today other than those in Australia, and oddly enough, just a few in South America, which was also isolated as an island some years ago, we give birth to young through a placenta. The young grow up inside the female's uterus until they reach a critical phase. Marsupial animals, the placenta isn't formed, and the young essentially are given birth to the young emerge from the birth canal and then attach to a mammary gland on the female's body when they're tiny, just incredibly small, and then they develop in a pouch-like structure. Those animals we see today in Australia, and also the opossum, which actually had its origin in South America. And there's another South American marsupial that I've forgotten. Anyway, that was kind of long-winded. The nutshell version is that Australia was an island separated from the rest of the continents when placental mammals evolved. So it's got this remnant fauna that's just so cool.
Thank you again for calling. I appreciate your call. And Eric in Marengo, we are turning to you now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I had sort of an epiphany on evolution a few years ago. I've always accepted the theory, but it's always more meaningful when you understand it, you know, on a personal level. And late one night, I was looking at an iris, and from a certain angle, I realized that that flower looks like sort of an amped-up, ultra-uber-sexy insect.
Huh.
And it sort of is like this super insect, you know, fertile form, and I think that's why it attracts the insects. So this had to happen through evolution. This happened had to, you know, the flower tried mm-hmm. different designs and, until it found one that the insects liked.
Right. Right. That's like the peacock and the tail for plants. Being able to attract insects to your pollen-bearing parts and your pollen-receptive parts, that's the bottom line. That's sex. That's getting the genes into the next generation.
And so many of the plants, especially orchids, have phenomenal adaptations to lure in insects exactly where they need them to be.
Very.
Yes, and I just have one other comment about DNA, and evolution to me is what gives me hope for the future of our species, because now we have developed our technology to where we can actually make ourselves extinct, but the purpose of DNA is to survive, and
right.
I think our DNA is capable of switching on certain genes that will make us a more cooperative than competitive species, and hopefully pull our buns out of the fire.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I hope you're right.
I hope so, too. Oh, thank you, Eric, for calling. And Judith in Milwaukee, let's go to you next. Hi, Judith.
Hi. I wonder if your guest could talk a bit about the way the octopus lives in its environment and how it builds a garden or a grotto for itself, and why something like that would have evolved, and are they the only underwater species who does that?
Hmm.
Well, octopuses, in shallow water, they all like to live in a place where they feel safe, and that's in hard contact. They like to sit with their arms wrapped up over their head and their mantle, their body parts, and feel something hard around them. And that's because they're covered by a one cell thick layer of skin, and the only defense they have against predators is that layer of skin and whatever shelter they're living in. How they like to live their lives is to eat, to kill something and to poison it and dissolve it with their poison and then slurp it up with their radula, so their teeth. That's part of the mollusk bowel plan, if you will. Now, when they're not eating, and they do eventually eat their fill, they like to sleep. Octopuses have an unusual life history in that they're born, they hatch out of eggs at a relatively small size in shallow water. And as they grow, they keep eating, they have this phenomenal and exponential rate of growth that has them increase in size about 10 times for the first several weeks to months of life. After that, they slow down to a rate that's more comparable to 5 times. But at the end of that period of growth, which depending on the species can last from weeks to months to years, in the case of the giant Pacific octopus, females begin to have their ovary increase in size so that their eggs get ready to be deposited, and males start to get increasingly lusty, let's say. After that phase happens and the females find a grotto, if you will, to which they attach their eggs usually in strands, and they sit with them and comb them and aerate them for as long as it takes until they hatch. At that phase, both the male and the female have come to the end of their lives. Octopuses are semoparous, and that means females reproduce only once. They produce one clutch of eggs in their lives. Males can copulate with as many females as will have them, but they actually live about as long as their sisters. So it's not the energy to produce the eggs that tells the females it's time to go. It's simply their programmed life cycle.
Hmm.
So while they're young, they're out killing and eating, and when they're not eating, they're sleeping a whole lot. But when that phase is done, they stop eating, they go reproductive, and you can see an octopus who's had its life behind it. It's senescent. The eyes are cloudy, the skin is gray, the respiration isn't right, and it's just nature's way.
Mm.
There are other animals who do that, maybe salmon, but we think of it, we being the opposite of semoparous, we have a long, multiple reproductive history, we think of it as a real waste. But it works for them. It's like gorillas and humans, you know? Gorillas aren't losers because they're not human. Octopuses aren't losers because they don't have long lives. The longest-lived octopus is probably the giant Pacific octopus. Some individuals may live 4.5 to 5 years. Small octopuses, maybe 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
Their whole life, 6 months?
Yeah, live fast, die young. And they do. They grow phenomenally. There's one species who grows from 40 milligrams, that's 0.04 grams, to 40 grams, an increase of 10,000 times in 6 months. Wow.
Wow, indeed. And this is part of, I think, in some ways, what you'll be talking about on Friday, right? You're the Friday keynote speaker.
Yeah. How about that?
That's pretty neat, but I can see why they actually, you're very articulate and paint some very vivid pictures.
Thank you.
And you're speaking at 7 p.m. on Friday, February 10th, in the Forum at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. We call it WID on Orchard Street in Madison. You'll enjoy that building. You haven't seen it yet, I don't expect.
Oh.
Yeah, you're going to like that building. It's a new building here on the UW-Madison campus. Thank you so much, Janet, for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been fun. Thanks so much for calling.
Mm. Janet Voigt is Associate Curator of Zoology at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, and her PhD is in ecology and evolutionary biology from University of Arizona, and a featured speaker at the UW Darwin Day events this week in Madison. I should mention that if you'd like some more information on Darwin Day, and there's a schedule of events, there are things for kids, there's a whole lot going on over several days, go to the website. Actually, if you put Darwin Dave's UW-Madison, it's going to pop up, I think. But it's evolution.wisc.edu. You're going to find it. And I know there are Darwin Day's celebrations going on at other institutions as well. I know the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater has something, and I'm sure there are other spots around the state that have those as well. So, appreciate having Janet Voigt with us today. And we've been talking about how our bodies change in response to the demands of the world around us. I think the same can be said for our behaviors, and sometimes they develop in ways that aren't so good for us mentally or physically. We're going to talk about the health impacts of one of those, insomnia, with Dr. Ruth Benka of the Wisconsin Sleep Laboratory and Clinic. That's coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.